Hello and welcome to the Deep Track Podcast, an exploration of watches, trends, and culture with a few adventures along the way. I'm your host, Blake Bettner. This week, I'm happy to welcome my longtime friend and colleague, Stephen Pulverint. Stephen is an industry veteran who has his own media agency now called Rhyme and Reason. There, he helps brands tell more meaningful stories to really connect with the right group of consumers. We talk a little bit about that in this episode, as well as look back on Watches and Wonders and some of the trends, themes, some of the things that are still kind of in the back of our minds since the end of the show. And then we also talk about the general kind of media landscape, how that has evolved, what kinds of stories are being told these days, how that affects people on his side of the fence and my side of the fence. And then we talk about a new book that he has done in collaboration with Ressence and another friend of ours, Justin Haas. The book turned out really beautifully, and it catalogs all of the watches produced by Ressence from 2010 to 2023. It's a really beautiful publication here. They have a lot of watches that I was not previously familiar with in here, even some piece unique watches that were requested. It's full of great surprises, and it's just beautifully done. So I'll leave a link to the Ressence website where you'll be able to pick that up, hopefully relatively soon. Stephen has a very unique perspective on the industry, which I really appreciate, and he and I really see eye to eye on a lot of things at a structural level in the watch industry and around collecting and things like that. So it was really fun to have him on and chat about his experiences and his more recent experiences in this space and what he's doing now. I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. A reminder that we do have new content coming up on YouTube this week and next week with a couple of reviews of the Notice Raven Trail Trekker, the Aquastar Benthos 500, and then we'll be looking back to the past a little bit with a review of the Rolex Sea-Dweller, a five-digit Rolex Sea-Dweller, 16600. So keep an eye out for that. You can head over to our YouTube channel and get subscribed if you're not yet. With that out of the way, let's get into my discussion with Stephen Pulverint. Enjoy. Stephen Pulverint, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, man. I've really been enjoying the show so far.
Well, I appreciate it, and we've been trying to make this work for a while now. So I'm happy that it finally has. Thank you for your time. There's a lot that I want to talk to you about today. You and I, of course, old friends and colleagues. There's a lot of old war stories we could get into if we wanted to, but there's other things that I want to talk to you about today. Before we get into some of that, though, maybe for anyone who's not familiar, give us a little intro of who you are and what you're up to these days.
Yeah, so I am probably, the people listening to this probably best know me from about a decade of acting kind of as a reporter and editor and personality on the media side of things, mostly in the watch world, not exclusively. Also worked as a tech reporter briefly, worked in the design world for a little while as well, but really was a media person. Worked at Hodinkee, worked at Bloomberg, Surface Media, a variety of places. But for the last couple of years, I have had my own company, a company called Rhyme and Reason. We're a creative and marketing agency. We help brands tell stories and tell them in ways that add meaning to audiences' lives. So the idea that, content should be additive. It's not there just to fill space. It should, be a good use of time. So yeah, really working on that. And I'm also a photographer and an artist. And what else? That keeps me plenty busy. Trying to think. I'm like, what else? What else do I do? That's what I do.
Very prolific, of course. Do you still run too on the side?
Yeah, I haven't been running as much lately. I ran the New York City Marathon in 2022. And kind of was like pushing through an injury to run that. Probably in a way that was stupid. But yeah, I took a couple of months off to recover after that, and honestly have not gotten back into the swing of things. But I was a relatively competitive runner there for a couple of years.
Yeah, I love that. And you have, how long? You've been in LA for a few years now, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, we're coming up on 4 years. This fall will be 4 years. I moved out here. My wife and I loaded up our Toyota Prius in New York City on Halloween of 2020. Wow. Drove across the country during the week of the presidential election, got to LA in a different car than we left in. We had a car accident in the middle of the country, bought a new car, kept going,
Wow.
And within a couple weeks decided we weren't leaving. So yeah, we've been out here. November will be 4 years.
Incredible. That sounds like quite the adventure that you've
Yeah,
got
it
yourself
was.
hooked up.
It really was. Getting in a car accident in rural Arkansas the day before the 2020 election was a little unnerving, but
Sure, naturally.
we got through it. Yeah, we got through it, and it's been nice. Really, really enjoying life out here, and yeah, it's been nice place to start my new company as well.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I really love what you're doing over at Rhyme and Reason. We've had a chance to work together a
Thanks, Ben.
time or two. Is there anything that you miss about New York? And I think
Oh
we live
yeah, I
in a
mean,
very close proximity to where you used to live here in Brooklyn. Is there like one thing over here that you're like, you know what, I
yeah.
really miss, or you get a hankering for this or that?
Oh man. Oh, what do I miss? I mean, to be honest, I miss things about New York every day. I miss the people, I miss the culture. I miss a good bodega sandwich on the way to work, you know.
Sure,
Grabbing a bacon, egg, and cheese on the way to work is pretty clutch. But yeah, honestly, the thing I miss about New York is that energy. LA is wonderful, and honestly, it's way healthier for me, the energy out here. But I do miss that fire sometimes. I miss that feeling of everybody kind of like pushing and encouraging each other and kind of grinding it out. Yeah, it's been I'm a big New York sports fan. It's playoffs time for the New York Rangers, so
Yeah,
been
tonight
kind of
they
getting
close
my
it out.
like I'm really hoping so, man. But I really hope by the time people hear this, I don't sound like an idiot saying that. But yeah, it's been nice to kind of have a couple hours every couple of days to kind of live that energy. I really miss that, and those are my people. It's where my family's from, so
Oh,
it's
sure.
really yeah, I really miss that, the people and that whole kind of like feeling of being in New York. But I'm lucky I get back a couple times a year, and both to see family and for work. So it's nice. I don't have to miss it for very long at any given time, which is great.
It's nice. I love both cities for very different reasons. And there's a nice energy out there in LA that I really crave sometimes. And then I find myself out in California for whatever reason, and I'm like, oh, this is nice out here, so I don't
Exactly.
bug you at all. So you and I had a chance to connect. We saw each other last in Geneva a few weeks back now, a month ago, something
Yeah.
like that. Now that some time has passed and all of the initial kind of hype and big reactions from the show are kind of behind us, is there anything in hindsight that maybe you didn't notice in the time from Watches of Wonders that has started to come back to you as like, you know what, that was a really cool watch, or something that's kind of just been lingering in the back of your head since the show that you maybe initially glossed over?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the show was interesting for me this year because it's the first time I've ever been there not predominantly as a journalist, where I was really mostly there meeting with clients, meeting with prospective clients, doing some work for existing clients. So it was interesting because it's a very different experience than being there as pure press. That said, in terms of specific watches, I think it's less for me about individual unsung pieces and more about the kind of overall takeaway. And I think coming out of the show, there was a bit of this like give and take between the overall atmosphere seemed, I think, better than most of us expected. Like there was less doom and gloom, less talking about tightening belts, cutting budgets, worrying about layout, like the bad stuff. People didn't seem as worried as I expected, which was nice. And on the flip side, I think there was some disappointment, especially amongst the press, that maybe it was an underwhelming year overall in terms of new products. In hindsight, I would push back against that second one a little bit. I think it's tough when you're media, you're all in it all day, every day. And so you crave newness because that's what you're looking for. That's what your job is. But to a large extent, that doesn't actually make a meaningful difference for end customers. And we're in this market where the watches that people actually want are a relatively narrow band of what's out there. And those things are unattainable. So putting out more unattainable things is just feeding that nonsense. And nobody likes that. You know, like there's this feeling out there, I think, that like maybe the brands like this. They don't. Like spoiler, you know, not even spoiler alert, but just like peek behind the curtain for anyone who thinks that. It's not that cynical. Like these are companies, most of them publicly traded. Like they actually have a legal responsibility to make as much money as they possibly can. So like they're not making watches because they like have some 4D chess thing to maintain prestige and whatever. It's just like they flat out can't make enough of them. You know, like demand shot up, they can't make them. So for me, to get back to your question, like the thing that I'm taking away is I'm actually really impressed with the restraint everyone showed coming out of, you know, three of the strongest years the watch industry has ever seen on a whole. You know, refraining from trying to swing for that next home run and just like hitting a single up the line, I think is a nice thing there. We saw a lot of new watches that people will actually buy, you know, things like the monochrome Black Bay, things like new Rolex GMTs, things like new IWC Portuguesers. Like these are watches that will be made in the tens of thousands. People will actually buy them. They will actually be able to get them. They will love them, and they're better than what came before. So like, sure, it's not some new complication. It's not some crazy headline grabbing thing. But I think on the whole, those products actually make a bigger splash than the kind of like halo things. So yeah, I guess my big takeaway would be I'm just I would push back a little bit against the like quote unquote it's a disappointing year vibes that I think a lot of the media put out there personally.
I think that's a good takeaway from it. And I kind of largely follow along similar lines here. You know, I think the watch industry was kind of at risk of being pulled into this release cycle, kind of akin to the fashion industry or the sneaker industry or something like that, which is probably not a healthy thing to do for a lot of these watch brands. And there were some really interesting
No.
watches released this year, but you maybe had to look between the cracks to find them. And when you did, it was great. And maybe nothing like you know, like you said, blockbuster new complication or something like that. But iterations on existing things, you know, like the Kodo, for instance, we saw kind of another iteration of that, which is still just as immensely impressive as it was when it was initially released. The Jaeger
Completely.
LeCoultre Duomet, you know, saw some new iterations there, which you know, all incredibly beautiful watches, incredibly impressive watches. And
Totally.
then, yeah, the watches like the, you know, the Tudor Black Bays and the monochromes of the world, you know, if it means that more people have more options and not only more options, but also more availability, then I think that's a net positive, for the enthusiasts in this space, at least, right?
I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, if we want to look, you know, between the cracks, things that I really liked. I mean, I was fortunate to get to see the Grand Seiko novelties again just a couple of days ago here in LA, and to like look at them in natural light and like really enjoy them as opposed to 30 minutes in a dark booth, which was amazing. And like the new 9SA4 pieces, the SLGW002 is the gold one, and I can't remember the reference on the titanium, but they're great and like they're really nice. And yeah, are they a little pricey? Sure, like we can have that conversation, but like it's a beautiful hand wound high beat watch for, you know, we're talking low five figures in titanium. Like that's a cool watch. The Chopic Promenade, like that's a cool watch. I've never seen dials like that. I can honestly say I've looked at thousands and thousands of watches over the last 10 to 15 years. I've never seen a watch like that. So like that kind of stuff is cool. And yeah, and like I said, like IWC, I really love the Eternal calendar. You know, it's I don't know, like, yeah, it's a large perpetual calendar. Like, okay, but I think it's interesting. It's cool. It's a cool way to do something different.
Yeah, it is an interesting watch. And even just the automatic 40s, for instance, are
Dude,
lovely.
100%.
You know.
Yeah, the gold one with the obsidian dial, like I would wear the hell out of that watch. And then even like the weird experimental stuff, like does Tag Heuer need to be making a skeletonized Rattrapant Monaco? No, they super don't. Like I guarantee you that does nothing for their bottom line. and won't do anything for their bottom line for like 10
Yeah.
to 15 years minimum.
Yeah.
However, it's cool. Like, I'm not upset about it. It was cool to see it.
Yeah.
The
Yeah.
crazy sapphire stuff that Hublot is doing, like,
Yeah.
puts a smile on my face. So, yeah,
Yeah.
I think we have to recalibrate expectations. I think, to your point, this isn't sneakers, this isn't streetwear, this isn't, runway fashion. This isn't a business fundamentally based on newness. It's fundamentally based on longevity. And
Yeah.
the idea that every one of these watches is sold under the auspices of, oh, well, you'll have it for generations, it'll outlive you.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, everybody's like, well, what's new this year? It's like,
Yeah.
well, if you're hoping to have it for 100 years, why does it matter if it came out this year or last year? You know,
Yes,
like
yes.
those are contradictory ideas.
This is the
And
irony.
that's understandable.
Yeah, it's
But yeah.
that's the conceit of the industry and kind of that trajectory that it
100%.
had been going. So, and I think there's something there that motivates both you and I in a very similar way. And before we touch more on that, I forgot to do a wrist check in the early part of the episode. What are you wearing today, Stephen?
Yeah, so I am wearing my vintage Rolex Explorer.
Okay.
It's a 1016, gilt dial, early 60s. It's on a stretch bracelet, a stretch oyster bracelet,
Nice, okay.
which is actually what kind of like convinced me to buy this particular example.
Yeah.
I wanted this bracelet. I have a friend who also owns a 1016 early gilt Omnith bracelet, and he's owned it much longer than I have. Always admired his watch, and when this one became available, I guess in like 2018, maybe. I've had it a little while. Yeah, I took the plunge and absolutely love it. Wear it all the time. Not as much as I should, but I wear it quite a bit, and yeah, I really love it.
Yeah. And you're the kind of like a less is more collection kind of guy, right? Kind of take the time with
Yeah.
what you have, enjoy it, build the memories, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, best I can. You know, my
Yeah.
collection's obviously ballooned over the years. I used to be one of those like, oh, it all fits in one box. You know, it doesn't fit in one box anymore. But like,
Sure.
you know, it's under 15 watches.
Okay.
It's usually closer to 10. But yeah, yeah, I'm definitely a less is more kind of person, both in terms of I don't like collecting for collecting's sake. Like the idea of having a bunch of watches in the bank or a bunch of watches in a safe that just like don't get touched actually causes me anxiety. Like I don't like knowing that they're just sitting there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not for any like security reasons. It feels wasteful to me. Like it feels like these things could be providing somebody else with happiness,
Yeah.
and I get no happiness from knowing that they're in a box in my closet or in a bank vault.
Yeah.
I know some people do, no judgment, but like that doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
So my kind of rule is like if over like a 6 month period I find myself not wearing something, I try to get rid of it just because I don't want that. That's not the kind of collection I want. I also collect other things, some of them with my wife, and so it's like if I have a watch that's sitting and not being used, that could be a piece of furniture, it could be a piece of art, it could be ceramics, it could be a trip, like it could be loads of
Sure.
different things.
Yeah.
And then yeah, on an individual watch basis, I think at this point, everything I own with, I guess there's like two or three exceptions, everything's either time only or time and date, you
Okay.
know.
Okay.
I've got one or two chronographs, mostly less expensive chronographs. And then I've got like some G-Shocks and stuff, but
Sure. Sure.
other than that, it's mostly like Explorer, IWC Pilot Watch, three hand Grand Seikos, three hand Cartier. Like it's pretty pared down.
Yeah, love it. You actually have one of my favorite pilot watches from IWC, and I think Seritanium is like a really interesting material, and I like how it's
Yeah.
used on that watch, and I would like to see it more often. I'm wearing the Ingenieur, the 3289 with the
Oh, nice.
octodial. This is a watch I'd love to see in Serenitatum. I feel it would be like almost
Yeah, dude.
unattainable, given like how difficult it is for them to make the bracelets, I think, is at least as far as I understand. But I like that material, and it's one of those things that kind of like defies expectations. It doesn't really photograph the way that it looks in person and the way that it feels in
Yeah,
person. It has
agreed.
some qualities that you just need to see it in person to like fully appreciate, I think.
I could not agree more. And since the watch came out, which is it's the Hodinkee IWC collaboration. It's the three-hand kind of vintage style pilot's watch, but with the Serenitatum case. Since it came out, IWC started making a bracelet in Serenitatum that fits that case. They make a 20-millimeter lug, I think it's the three-link bracelet. And the only issue is it's more expensive than the watch,
I was gonna say
because the Serenitatum is so hard to make. It's hard to work with. It's hard to finish. So the bracelet is more than the watch. But to be totally honest, I have multiple times thought like maybe I would get more enjoyment out of just buying this bracelet than out of buying a new watch. Because I wear that watch so much and I so often want it on a bracelet. I think that's probably going to happen at some
At
point.
some point soon.
Luckily, I think I know some folks at IWC who might be able to
You know a
help me
guy.
out there. But yeah, I know a guy or two. But yeah, it's a really great material, and I was really fortunate to get to over the years visit the manufacturer and see how it's made, and it's pretty wild. I met the guy who invented it, who's like a total sweetheart and a genius.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a cool thing, and it's something proprietary, and it's something genuinely proprietary, as opposed to like, hey, there's 12 companies using this and they all have different trademark names for it. It's like this is like actually unique, which is nice.
All right, I want to take a step back because and kind of talk about how we
Sure.
like to tell stories and what motivates us to tell stories around this stuff, especially given like people like you and I who aren't like kind of wanting to see the industry kind of fall into where it's like it always has to be kind of a new re hype releases kind of one after another. But instead of
Yeah.
building a foundation around that idea that you mentioned that these things are being sold as something that you should wear and enjoy and build a relationship with and over the course of decades and generations, even, right? That's even the tagline of some famous watch brands. And I like thinking about watches like that and the types of meanings that they can, like how it changes over your time with it. And I'll be honest with you, I don't consume a whole lot of watch media.
Sure.
That's like I don't know if that's a weird thing, but I find that it will often kind of affect like how I want to tell stories or what I should be doing, or it kind of stresses me out. So I kind of think about what are the stories that I
Totally.
want to be telling with this, right? And you mentioned something there around the Watches and Wonders in particular, because it always kind of comes up there when you're on the media side creating content. It's kind of your priorities has to be on these kind of few watches from a few brands that you know will get the most traction and the most traffic. And even if it's not the watches that you find the most interesting or the watches that you have the most to say about, it's like, well, this is, I did some video or some content around, Piaget and Parmigiani, and it just doesn't get the traction, unfortunately, of like, a Tudor. And, not that I think Tudor's doing anything wrong there, but it kind of, it can be restrictive, it feels like, if you're on the media side and well, this is where all my time and efforts have to go into creating content around these things, but I really want to talk about these things, which I'm sure that Piaget and Parmigiani, like they want that too. But I don't know what it is, about though they're and not just them, but a lot of other brands who do really interesting things. This year, particularly Parmigiani, I think you and I were both huge fans of the new Toric.
Yeah,
Watches
huge.
and those are maybe the more like slower burn type watches or things that like after the kind of initial spike of hype or excitement around the new GMTs or whatever fades away that people notice the things like this. I don't know if brands express concerns to you around this practice of kind of well, everything that gets attention right off the bat kind of falls in this small circle. So what do you, what a brand that falls outside of that circle, kind of how do they break into that consciousness,
Yeah, I think it comes down to a couple of things. I think, one, that circle, I think, is actually maybe breaking up a little bit. I think as, the primary methods of consuming content, right, are moving from people consuming natively, on an app or on a website. Everything's moving to social and discovery. It's been moving that way for years. The watch world, as we know, is always a couple of years behind everybody else. So, you know, maybe that transition is a little bit newer than in other places where it's been that way for 5, 10 years. Or I guess a little more than that now. But yeah, I think there's more room for things to break out now and for things to get attention from unexpected audiences and from audiences outside of the usual suspects. I think there's always a core audience of people who just want to know what the new Rolex is. They just want to know what the new Patek is. They just want to know how much the new Tag Heuer costs. They want whatever, you know? But then there's an audience who is maybe a layer below that, who wants to know what Piaget is doing for the 175th anniversary. They want to know what Guido is doing at Parmigiani and what the new Toric is. And then I think there's even like an audience a layer below that that doesn't even know they're interested in watches, but when they see something cool, they get it. I can say, you know, just speaking personally, I put up some pictures. I was very fortunate to get to see a friend, Sylvain Bernaron, who has his own watch company, Bernaron. And they're doing this sort of like, the best way to describe it on audio is it is something inspired by shaped watches, like the Crash, for example. But really with like a watchmaking first mentality. So it's a shaped movement. It's the case is shaped around the movement. Like it started with the gear train. It's really fascinating. The movement's made of gold. It's, you know, very small series, very small production. It was great. And Sylvain had his first, you know, real production watches in Geneva. So we grabbed a coffee and I got to take some pictures of them. It's the most interacted with thing I've put on social media
in
years.
That's good to know.
Legitimately.
I'll put a link to this down below. This watch is almost impossible to describe through words.
Yeah.
You just have to look at
it. It's really tough. Like I'm trying to think of how to describe it, but it's like, it's in that vein of the Cartier Crash, but with a kind of modern independent watchmaking spirit behind it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I'm still getting like new follow. I mean, I posted this now almost a month ago. I'm getting new follows. It's still like must be getting pushed in people's Discover pages because it's cool and it's different. And people who are not like you and me, like watch people in quotes, they see it and they're like, holy shit, what is this?
Yeah.
And they like want to lean in. And so again, to get back to your question, like I think one of the ways those brands can cut through is not by trying to tell the same stories to the same people that everybody else is. It's like, you know, if you're at a party and you go up to somebody and you're like, oh, this is the host of the party and I want to go talk to them. And there's 10 people crowded around them, all talking at them. You can go stand two or three people back and try to yell over them. You're not going to end up having a conversation.
Yeah.
But if you go to the other side of the room, there's probably somebody else who'd really be excited to chat with you.
Yeah.
And I think that is the strategy. I think yelling over the noise, it's just not going to happen. And to a large extent, the brands who are in that tiny circle, who are getting all the attention at 8 a.m. the first day of the fair,
yeah,
like they're in some ways in a different business than everybody else. You know, like Rolex and Parmigiani are not actually very similar at all. You know,
yeah,
they both make things that you wear on your wrist. But other than that, I would be willing to bet that very few things about the business, the customers, the sales strategy, like it's all different. So do your thing. Don't try to do somebody else's thing.
Yeah.
Because if you're the best version of you, that's going to be way more successful than being the B-list or C-list version of somebody else. And I don't mean in terms of the product output. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. I just mean like seeing what somebody else does to be successful might not be what you need to do to be successful.
Yeah.
And being thoughtful about that is, I think, my biggest piece of kind of like global advice.
Well, I think the same applies kind of on this side of things too, on the media side. And I know that you're a photographer. And I like photography is something that I enjoy a lot as well. I call myself a photographer. I take a nice snap every now and then, but it's something that I'm really fascinated.
I think you can call yourself a photographer. I think that's allowed, my friend.
I have to, right? Like, yeah, but it's, I do consume like watch like media in the photography space. And there's a few channels that I find particularly like really inspiring, and I don't see anybody doing stuff like that. like in the watch world, and I always wonder why. Like the GX Ace, like James Popsis, and yeah, there's a few others, you know, people that I just find really, but I guess it's kind of around the aesthetic, right? It, just naturally. And they're, but they're, how they tell a story around this. And I, you know, I mentioned to you the Fujifilm, the X106 coming out, how they brought all those photographers out to Japan and kind of just cut them loose. And all the different types of video content that we got from the people that were there was just kind of so diverse. You know, I found it something that I found really inspiring. And so that's kind of where I find myself looking to. Like, how does your photography and your consumption of that space affect how you think about the watch industry? Or does it at all?
I mean, it definitely does. But I think, you know, to your point, the idea that like a watch brand would fly a bunch of journalists to, let's say, like London, give them all a new watch and be like, hey, here's a loaner, and we'll see you in 48 hours, return the watch, have a nice time. Like, it's crazy. It's like you can't get 5 minutes alone with a product. Like, everything is so controlled. I can't imagine the watch world ever doing that. I also like can't imagine what would come out of that. It would be kind of
It'd be probably
baffling,
some maybe
but
cool stuff though, right?
maybe. I mean, I think like you brought up the GX Ace thing and, you know, the Fuji review in particular, and like that review of the X100 is like only borderline a camera review. Like it's kind of like a 15-minute David Fincher film. Like it's like weird and disorienting, and like if you showed it to me and didn't tell me it was a camera review, it would take me 2 or 3 minutes to realize that this is about a camera. But it's cool, it's interesting, it's different, it got my attention. And I think that kind of creativity is awesome. And I think to your point, like storytelling, right? Everything I do now on a daily basis is about storytelling. If it wouldn't sound like the most obnoxious, pretentious thing in the entire world, like my business would advertise itself as a storytelling agency. But that sounds so obnoxious. I typed it on like a faux like letterhead thing. It was just like, absolutely not.
You gotta be that
But
guy.
yeah, I was like, no, this is a hard no from me. But that's at the core of what we're doing, you know? And I think one of the things that these folks on the camera side have thought about, and I think it applies to lots of other consumer media, tech reviews, guys like Marques Brownlee is great at this. Like, they think about the fact that the media environment is saturated and that people are busy. And if you're gonna commit to watching a 15-minute YouTube video about a camera, it can't just be a rundown of the specs of the camera, because those exist in 4,000 other places that you can read on your phone while you're also cooking dinner or listening to a podcast and watching TV all at the same time. So if you're going to sit down, it needs to really add value. It needs to capture your attention, and it needs to be something that after 15 minutes, the viewer goes, hey, that was cool. Like, maybe I want to watch another one. Or, hey, I feel like I learned something, I'll come back next time. And all too often, I think we forget to ask ourselves in the watch world, what value does this bring to the user? It's very clear what value producing content brings to the media producers. It's very clear what value it brings to the producers of the products that are being covered. It's not always clear to me what value it brings to the end consumer. And that's something I tell my clients all the time, is that to me, when I was making a podcast, to me, the worst possible piece of feedback was not that episode sucked, I hated your opinion, you sounded stupid on mic. Like, none of that stuff bothered me. People have opinions, it's fine. It's like sometimes it's helpful feedback, you learn from it. Sometimes it's not, and you just let it roll off. To me, the thing that would kill me would be if people were like, that was a waste of time. Because I always felt like that was kind of a contract I had with my audience, was like, I'm going to give you, trust me to give you stuff that's worth your time, because you're giving me, you know, at the time it was about an hour a week of your life. I have a responsibility to put in the work and the effort and the thought to deliver you something that is worth an hour of your life. If I don't, then like you shouldn't listen. And like my show should fail. You know, like that's the end of the day. What should happen?
Yeah.
And I feel the same way about the work I do with my clients. And I tell people that all the time, whether it's, you know, independent media work or whether it's content a brand is creating or a retailer is creating or a hospitality company is creating, it doesn't matter what vertical it's in. We have to give something to the audience. Like there's fundamentally an act of generosity at the core of it. And if there's not, then you're kind of taking advantage of somebody. You're kind
Me
of
too.
using somebody. And that's not, I don't think that's a long-term recipe for success. So I try not to do it. And I try to encourage my clients not to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find myself, you know, on this end, thinking less and less about, you know, the diameter and the lug to lug and the you know, caliber. Yeah, I mean that's all there, but it's secondary, and it's what there has to be something else here for me to talk about, or for me to like you know, grab onto to really kind of express something that I think about it. And at the end of the day, I think that's what will set me apart from anybody else. And there's a lot of people doing some great work, but you know, that's why I kind of stopped paying attention to other media and thinking
well,
of it as regurgitating
it's
a press release. You know, it has to be something else, right?
Dude, you're 100% right. And like, I'm sure you've experienced this, but like, how many times does a team of 5 or 6 people, including writers, editors, video producers, shooters, video editors, colorists, like you have a whole production team produce a many minute long review. It takes weeks. Lots of thought and effort goes into it. You're shooting out in the world. You're putting the watch in an environment. You're styling it with different clothes. You're taking it on different adventures, whatever. And then like comment number one is like, what's the lug to lug? And you're like, did you not pay attention to any of this? Like, did you not? Like, if that's what you wanted, that's on the manufacturer's website. Like, I don't need to give that to you. And like, what I gave you is a vision of what this watch could look like, not in the glass display cabinet, which is the only place you as a member of the normal public can experience one of these without spending $20,000 or whatever it is. And it's like, we took it out into the world and showed you how it could feel and what experiences it connects with. And your question is about like a 2 millimeter difference this way? Like what? And so I'm totally with you. And I think to some extent it's because we've all trained audiences poorly to expect that kind of thing.
I know
but
it is guys like
it's
you and
not
I's fault.
On totally 100%. Like I take 100% of the blame for it too, but it's to your point, it just like does not interest me anymore. And except for like, obviously I consume a lot of watch media now as like a professional obligation. Like I need to be aware of what's going on in order to know like what the trends are and to know what people are saying and what sentiments are for client purposes. Like it's just, it would be irresponsible of me to my clients to not be aware of those things. But from a personal standpoint, there's very little watch media I consume, mostly just because I feel like I've seen it all. And I feel like, you know, even the people who are doing a great job, I do this all day. So for me, it's like a busman's holiday, you know, like I want to do something else when I want to relax. But it's, I will say I love the explosion in the, I think there's positives and negatives. But I think overall, it has been exciting to see the professionalization of watch media, especially on the digital side. We obviously had, you know, well-run trade magazines for a very long time. But then there was this period where we were all kind of, and like you and I were a part of this, like we were bloggers in the truest sense. Like we had cell phone cameras and inexpensive digital cameras. We had Tumblr sites and Squarespace sites. And our goal was just to push out as much content as quickly as possible about the most products we could with a point of view. But like, it was largely a volume game and a speed game. And it was hobbyists becoming professionals. And now it's very professionalized, which is cool because like production value is through the roof. There's more people with more opinions and more kind of like little niches than ever before. And that's great. Like, I love that. The more people who can make a living at this and like spend their days doing a thing that they love and that they care about instead of like making widgets at the widget factory. Like, good for them, you know? I don't begrudge anybody that.
It's bringing,
However, I think there are some downsides too, which is that as it's become more professionalized, I do think it's lost a little bit of that like excitement that maybe it had.
So I'm trying to be conscious of not taking myself too seriously. Like
Yeah, totally. I think that's a good thing.
it still has to be about, my perspective that I bring to it, and that's what I think keeps people coming back to me, maybe. But I think you mentioned
Yeah, I
something
mean, I
in
think
there.
like take the work seriously, but not yourself seriously. That's a I
It's a
can't
good way to
remember who
put it.
said that, somebody famous, but like I just think that's a good thing to keep in mind.
So speaking of that, I want to, and especially watches that you should experience and not kind of adhere to a spec sheet about Bressence. You had a
Yeah.
project that you did with Benoit of Bressence and with our friend Justin Haas as well. And it's this
Yeah.
beautiful book. It's a catalog of their work. It's volume one, so more to come. This is what
It
it
is,
is.
yeah.
2010 to 2023, a catalog of the watches
Yes.
produced in that time frame. So it goes through all of the different it's types, type one, type three, four, five, eight, even. There's a lot of watches in here, and a lot of them I was not prior familiar with. And this is the brand that I follow.
Yeah,
So
yeah,
it's
yeah,
just
yeah.
such a cool thing. How did you get involved in this project? And tell me about what you were able to bring to the table here for this thing.
Yeah, so I mean, first thing, I'll go back to the beginning of my involvement with Resonance, which is, you know, early on in my watch days at Hodinkee, I was roughly aware of Resonance. I had like heard of them, kind of like I'd seen them. I think I'd seen Ben write about them at some point. But I did a little like hands-on video. I don't think it's even online anymore. I think it got lost in a data migration years ago, but like it was shot on like a Canon like PowerShot. It's like a real janky you know, early days, like mid 2012 video. Hands-on with the Zero series, which is the Resonance that has a crown still. This is before the crown went away. And I remember just being like, oh, like this is what a watch can be. Like it was in the same vein as like the first time I saw an MB&F, or even the first time I wore a Vacheron for a couple days. And I was like, oh, like this is different. This is something way deeper and way more interesting. So I've known Benoit forever, at least forever in terms of my involvement in the watch business. And yeah, and Justin and I have been friends a long time. And Justin came to me a little over a year ago now and said to me, I have this crazy idea. It's coming up, you know, it's been at the time it had been 12 years. We thought 12 years, 12 hours on a clock, like it's a nice time to do something. And Justin had this idea to produce a book that would have every watch Resonance had made to date with as much information as we could possibly get. And that we were in this rare position where Benoit, the founder of the brand, is still there. He's running it day to day. He's doing everything. He's young. He's very with it. He's super smart.
Still
And
enthusiastic
it
about
wasn't
it.
s still enthusiastic about it. And it wasn't so far from the origin date that if things hadn't been kind of recorded properly, we could still capture them before they were lost. And with so many of these indie brands, either the founder, by the time the brand really gets off the ground, the founder is like in their mid-80s and like kind of losing it a little bit, or not able to like be in the business every day, whatever. And so we thought it was this really unique opportunity. So Justin asked me, I was excited. And then we took it to Benoit, and Benoit thought we were nuts, which I think is a great
Naturally.
reaction. Like it was cool. It was great. I appreciate that he was honest with us. And he said to us, I'm happy to do it, but I don't think the two of you know what you're signing up for. And we said, okay, like if you think we're crazy, we'll take that on us. And it turned out he was right. He was totally right. Which is why it ended up coming out 13 years, not 12 years after the brand's founding. It took us almost a year to do this book. And a lot of that was just digging for information. It was just getting the information, making sure we had it, making sure we were clear. And we settled on this format of a catalog resume, which you see a lot in the art world. It's kind of like the definitive guide. So in the art world, if you want to go buy a Mark Rothko painting, whoever the foremost expert is on Mark Rothko, probably a curator at the MoMA or the Tate, like one of the big world museums, that person will have produced a work of scholarship called a catalog resume. It's usually like for an artist like that, five, six, seven volumes. They're these huge $1,000 books. It's really over the top. And if you want to go buy a Rothko painting at Christie's, you check if it's in the catalog resume to make sure it's authentic. It'll have the history of who owned it, all of that. It's like really a like the Bible for these artists. We wanted to do that for Resins. So this book, fundamentally at its core, is an accounting. It's making sure that we have all the information. So we have every watch the brand has produced. We have serial numbers. We have production numbers, production dates. We have anecdotes directly from Benoit, like in his own voice. It's all written first person, saying like, I was approached by so and so. We did this. We tried this. It didn't work. Like brutal honesty about stuff like, the blue dials, for example, after a certain date, they changed color. And even within a production series. So if you buy a Type 1 squared night blue, there are actually two night blues, and they have the same name and they're the same reference number, but there's a date at which they change. And the reason they change is because the supplier they were using was damaging too many components. And it just wasn't making sense. They were having to damage out too much. It was delaying production. So they switched suppliers. And every supplier who does these galvanic treatments and these PVD treatments, the colors are slightly different because they're proprietary chemical processes. So we have in here, like, hey, the original supplier quality dropped. So we dropped them. We moved to a new supplier, and the blue is a little different. I can't think of another brand that would admit to that, but
It's all the
it's
community
here.
that
It's
does
in the
it, right?
book.
Like the Mark II, three
Exactly.
dials, or Rolex. Like it's all the community that does it.
And we wanted to have it on the record, set the record straight, make sure information was clear. And in no small part, it comes from Benoit and his team, Simon, Baya. I mean, there's an amazing team at Resonance. And a lot of it comes from them in that, like, they really appreciate that when clients buy a Resonance, they have lots of options. And Resonance is usually the weird option. It's like the unusual choice. And they appreciate that people are willing to take that leap with them, and people are willing to go on this journey, and they want to make sure that they're being transparent, they're being open, and that they show that same respect back. So, there were times, honestly, I can't share what information, but there were times where there was information like Justin and I decided not to include. We were like, this feels like maybe a little too much. It's a little too like personal, or it involves like particular people or blah blah blah, and we removed that. But yeah, and then we got to find some cool piece uniques that like I didn't know existed. There's some gem set resin watches, which like I had never heard of.
There's a
A
handful of
rendering
surprises
landed
in here
my
for me that I was like shocked to see
and it's cool. And
it's such a cool experience looking through this. Where can
thank you.
is
I'm
this
really glad to
available? Will
hear that.
people be able to go buy it somewhere?
So it will be available through Resins and through their retailers shortly. We're still figuring out exactly who's getting how many copies, how they're going to be distributed. This first print run is like not tiny, but relatively small. So yeah, the priority is to make sure that collectors and clients who want them get them, and then they'll become generally available. We'll do a second printing if we need to. And then, as you said, this is volume one. The idea is that every few years, when there's enough new watches to warrant an update, we'll update it. We'll add what was missing. We'll revise anything we found that wasn't 100%. Add some additional history. I mean, we have some things in here like a glossary of some of the special terms. We have how the Resonance logo changed over the years. We can add more of these kind of like color things as well over the years, but the idea is that long term, if you want to collect Resonance watches, we will, and by we, I mean Resonance the brand, but hopefully with Justin and my help, make sure you always have the best information available. We don't want this to be a thing where you have to go to like some dude on a forum who says that they know what's going on. Like, we should just be able to go to the book and know.
Absolutely. I wish more brands would do stuff like this. Hats off to you and Justin for getting it done. I'll leave a link
Thank
to
you.
his account
Thank
down
you.
below. He's another great guy that you should be following if you're not. And
Thanks.
Steven,
And
I
I also
can't
just
thank you
want to
enough.
call out, I just want to call out real quick also the guys at Birch Design in London who designed the book. Mark and James were like absolutely brilliant to work with. These guys just taste level through the roof. All kinds of little touches, like if you look at the pages kind of on the opposite of the spine, there's these little gray tabs to show you which reference you're looking at. The corners are radiused really beautifully. And those decisions all came from those gents. So while Justin and I have our names as the editors, yeah, the Birch guys really just like crushed it, and we couldn't have made this without them. So I just
Awesome.
want to say thank you to those guys. They took really good care of us.
Well, the experience really comes through with the book in hand. It
Thank
turned out
you.
beautifully.
I appreciate that.
And we'll leave a link to the Reston's website down below as well. If you're into independent watchmaking of any kind, you should definitely check this book out. Stephen, I can't thank you enough for your time. It's just been a huge treat to chat with you today.
Dude, of course, man. Thank you. I'm always happy to chat. And yeah, like you said, we've been in the trenches together for many, many years. It's exciting to see you launch this. And yeah, I've really been enjoying it so far. So thank you for including me. And yeah, always happy to come on here and chat.
Well, I appreciate it very much, Stephen. I'll leave links to where people can go find more of you, to Rhyme and Reason, and
Thank
your
you.
social accounts down below. Thanks again for joining me. That'll do it for this week's episode. And thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care.